Well, good morning. We have a full house for our first argument of October. This morning, I see that we have Germantown High School students who are here with a Court with Class program. Would they please stand? Oh, wow. Well, you're the ones that make us have a full house. Thank you very much. Please be seated. Now, the students are here, as many of you know who are regulars in this court, in a program called Court with Class that the Supreme Court operates in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. And they have gotten materials about the case that we're going to have argued this morning, and their teacher has gone over those materials with them. Is there anyone that needs materials at this moment? Okay, very good. Well, we've had a little bit of a look at you, and let me introduce the court to all of you out there so you can have a little bit of a look at us, except for the nameplates that are here. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to her, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to me, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. On her left, Justice Michael Gableman. And at the far end of the bench, Justice Dan Kelly. So with those remarks, and let me remind those students from Germantown that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will talk with you at the break. So when we get done with the second case, not the first case, if you can come back in the courtroom, she will meet with you at that time. Now, she won't be talking about the... they're not returning. She sends me a little note that says not returning. Well, my sheet didn't tell me that. So I guess you won't get to meet with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. But
don't take that personally.
That's my
Justice
loss.
Bradley.
That's my loss.
Yeah, right. So in any case, thank you for joining us for the oral argument. We always enjoy having students with us to learn a little bit more about what the Supreme Court does and how they do it. So with all of those preliminaries, counsel, are you ready to begin? Please do.
Good morning. My name is Dustin Haskell, representing Tabitha Scruggs, the petitioner in this case. This case is about Wisconsin's DNA surcharge statute and the penalty that it imposes on criminal defendants. The statute requires $250 for every felony conviction and $200 for every misdemeanor conviction. That's really the end of the story. It doesn't matter if a person is given a DNA sample in the past or in connection with this case. It doesn't matter if the case has something to do with DNA testing or involves any DNA testing. You pay the surcharge, no matter what, for every conviction. And the problem is that's what makes it punitive, because that's really
well,
the question.
Well, the statute says if the defendant is sentenced after January 1, 2014, right?
Correct.
So your problem is this person is sentenced after January 1.
Our
this
problem...
The statute does apply on its face. On his face, it applies.
The statute does apply on his face.
To your client. The problem you have is that the crime was committed before January 1, 2014. Isn't that the crux of your argument?
Yes.
Okay. Is this statute retroactive?
Yes. The parties have agreed that it is being applied retroactively
is
in this case.
Is the word retroactive or retrospective? I see both words confused in this.
I think retrospective is generally the phrasing that the court has used in the past.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's retrospective in this case. The offense that was committed by the defendant was committed in 2013. She was sentenced in 2014 and required to pay this surcharge. At the time that she committed the offense, the surcharge was discretionary. Circuit courts across Wisconsin decided whether felons would pay a $250 surcharge. And in doing so, would exercise discretion before imposing that surcharge. The change in the law makes that surcharge mandatory now. There's no option but for circuit courts to impose $250 for every felony, in addition now, $200 for every misdemeanor. And our concern is that that's what makes this punitive. And the question that...
Excuse me, what makes this punitive, did you say?
That's what makes this punitive. I didn't hear
sure.
you.
Sure. No, what makes the surcharge punitive is the per conviction basis on which it is applied. Rather than...
You only have one conviction.
Correct. But the statute does not contemplate any limit to the number of surcharges that might be imposed. And this is where I think that there are a number of opinions from the lower court. We have the Court of Appeals opinion in this case and the Court of Appeals opinion in Radage, State v. Gregory Radage. In this case, yes, Ms. Scruggs has been ordered to pay one DNA surcharge. In Radage, there were four surcharges. The Court of Appeals in Radage, which preceded this case, indicated, you know, there really is a problem with making a person pay four DNA surcharges when it doesn't seem like there's anything that would require that many surcharges. There's nothing about DNA cost that would require that many. And the problem is that the statute, again, imposes a surcharge for every conviction.
Okay, so that's unconstitutional under the Court of Appeals. And the state's not challenging that. The state says, okay with us, as I understand the case.
Nobody has appealed Radage, or at least this court's not reviewed it, no.
Okay, so what's your gripe? You don't have multiple convictions. You got one.
We do. The problem is that the Court of Appeals has decided to break this out by looking at the DNA surcharge on an as-applied basis. Were you required to pay one? Were you required to pay four? Were you required to pay five? And the problem is that when looking at whether a statute violates ex post facto, you look at the statute on its face. And this is what makes, admittedly, an ex post facto challenge a little confusing, because it is inherently as applied.
But look.
There is nothing...
Can I just interrupt you for a minute?
Please.
A petition for review was filed here. And the petition for review is a facial challenge. Because a petition for review, the issue stated there, is a facial challenge as to all defendants who committed the crime prior to January 1, 2014. And had one conviction, because that was the prior Court of Appeal case took care of it. So I don't understand all this as applied versus facial. We took the case, and it was a facial challenge in the issue you presented in your petition for review. The state said, don't take the case because it's as applied and only affects this defendant. We didn't listen to them.
It's only as applied insofar as it applies to individuals sentenced after January 1st, 2014.
Okay.
I mean, that's as applied. That's not a facial challenge, because we acknowledge that if somebody commits an offense today and gets sentenced to 18 counts, they can pay 18 surcharges. There is nothing inherently wrong with the statute that's been passed.
Well, it's not an ex post facto issue. You can't say that they're not other issues. I don't know. But at
sure.
least it's not an ex post facto issue, and that's the issue presented today.
Agreed.
So if they committed the crime after January 1, 2014, you can't yell ex post facto.
Agreed.
You can yell something else if you want to.
Maybe, yeah.
Right. Now, if we take the position that this statute is valid as to one, which the state wants us to do, where there's just one conviction and one $250 charge, that still leaves open the question of a different case, a third case that can arise, where the defendant has a prior charge, or for any other reason, the defendant has submitted a DNA sample that is in the database, and now he's charged another $250. That would be left open, right? Because it's not a fact situation.
If this court were to render a decision essentially mirroring the Court of Appeals decision, then yes, those issues would remain unresolved. There would need to be further litigation. I believe that we have, in our office at least, a number of appeals that are raising that issue.
Yes, I understand that. That seems apparent in the discussion in the briefs.
Yes, and so that remains unresolved.
Counsel, if this is not an as-applied challenge, then it's a facial challenge. And don't you have the obligation of showing that there's no way in which the statute can be constitutionally applied to anyone?
Right, and that's where I think it only becomes a confusion about what's as-applied and what's facial. The statute facially is constitutional as far as ex post facto goes. There's no ex post facto on its face to the application of the statute prospectively. But when we're looking at anybody who committed their offense before January 1st, 2014, to all of those people, figuring out does it violate ex post facto, you can't look at how many convictions they had, how many charges they had. At that point, when looking at retrospective application, you have to look at the statute on its face.
So it's a facial challenge.
Why is that the case? Why do we have to look at this as if there are going to be multiple charges applied?
That's simply every case from this court that I've been able to find from the United States Supreme Court that discusses the ex post facto clause. The question is whether it is punitive on its face when applied retrospectively. The case that I think...
But it's not quite that broad, is it? When we look at, for example, Weaver, the United States Supreme Court asked whether it would be unconstitutional as to the petitioner and other similarly situated prisoners.
And I think that's exactly it. Other similarly situated, meaning those for whom the statute was applying retrospectively. In Weaver, for example, the case there was a statutory change to the good time statute that the court was that had been changed, a change to a good time statute. The defendant was challenging that because it resulted in his sentence increasing by about 2 years. But it wouldn't have mattered if it increased his sentence by only 5 days. It could have increased his sentence by 1 day. It's still an ex post facto violation because that's how we're looking at it on its face.
Let's take it one step further and go to Daubert versus Florida. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court said that you look at the sentence that was actually received. And in that case, the prisoner was sentenced to the death penalty. And he was challenging something applicable to if he had received a life sentence. Supreme Court said, well, you didn't get a life sentence, so we don't need to consider this.
Right. I agree. I think that Daubert is the only case that I've seen that was cited by the Assistant Attorney General in this case. The problem there is that I think that's more a problem of standing for that defendant. That defendant had been sentenced to death while his case was pending. The law had changed, allowing sort of requiring that life sentences have a minimum period of confinement of at least 25 years. But the problem is it doesn't...
Why isn't this a standing problem for Ms. Scruggs? She's saying, you know, if I had done more, I might have been convicted of more, and I would have had more surcharges. But she didn't. She had none.
I think that the, I guess, relatable counterfactual in Daubert would be if that defendant had been sentenced to life imprisonment, and it changed the amount of time that he was going to have to spend in prison. But it didn't change the defendant's sentence at all. As in contrast, Ms. Scruggs' sentence changed. She was facing a discretionary surcharge when she committed this offense. When she was sentenced, it was mandatory.
That's a different question, though, isn't it? That's a question of whether it becomes an ex post facto violation when you move from a discretionary imposition to a mandatory, not whether there's the potential for multiple surcharges.
I think the two are related. The fact that it's mandatory and the fact that it increases on a per conviction basis are two components of the statute that render it punitive.
Would it be appropriate for this court to consider only the move from discretionary to mandatory as part of the ex post facto analysis?
I don't believe so. Because I think, again, the analysis as to whether the statute violates ex post facto requires looking at the statute on its face as it could apply in any situation. This is something...
If the statute were written this way, tell me if this would change the analysis at all. The statute said, if convicted of one count, impose a $250 DNA surcharge. That's part A. Part B, if convicted on more than one count, impose a $250 DNA surcharge for each conviction. Would that change the analysis at all?
No, I don't think so. I think essentially that hypothetical is the exact same that we have here. I mean, if you commit one offense, you pay one. If you have more offenses, you pay them on a per conviction basis. I think that's the same as the statute as it is now, essentially.
Why are you relitigating a case that defendants won in a prior case where the Court of Appeals said if it's multiple convictions and multiple charges, it's an ex post facto? You won that. Why are you back here on that? Your case is not a multiple conviction case. Your case is not only your defendant, it's a lot of defendants with one conviction, and that for that one conviction for a crime committed before January 1, 2014, they are applying this statute retroactively. That's your case. It's not only as applied to your defendant, it's applied to everyone. One conviction, 201 sentencing after January 1, 2014, $250 for a felon. That's a facial challenge to what Justice Kelly has given you is two statutes. And you've got two fact situations, and this is one fact situation, and that's an imposing that you can separate that out. And that's what the court did, the Court of Appeals did, and said, oh, now we've got left the case you're presenting today. Why are you moving into multiple challenges? You've already won that.
Because the Court of Appeals in Radage got it right insofar as they examined the statute
on
a per conviction basis.
And they said the intent, if I understand the case, the intent of the legislature was to collect money so you can have DNA testing and you can put them into a database and that would be good for public safety. So the intent was not to punish. But they said the effect where you have multiple convictions is to punish. Because you got a $1,000 charge when it would have been a discretionary charge before. And they said discretionary versus $1,000. Isn't that what they said?
I think as to the first part, I don't think they answered intent. I think they expressed some serious doubt about legislative intent.
You don't have to have both intent and effect.
No,
you get effect, you've got it. Okay, so they got the effect. All right.
Right. And after that, what they do is essentially, while they apply it to an individual who happens to have four convictions, their analysis fundamentally applies to the statute on its face.
Okay, and then that's your position, that when you change it from, it seems to me, from discretionary to mandatory 250, that's ex post facto. It increases the burden on a defendant for a crime committed before the effective date. Before the effective date.
That's part of it, and I think that the problem is that, again, what makes it even worse here is that it can continue to be applied, again, endlessly. But even one does render it punitive.
You have to win on, and that's what the issue is that you presented to the court. So regardless of whether it's as applied or in effect, the petition for review and the issue you present in your brief on page one is, does retroactive application of mandatory DNA surcharge violate the prohibitions against ex post facto laws in the state and federal constitution?
Right. Without regard to how many there might be.
That's right.
If there's one, if there's five,
right.
it violates ex post facto. Right. The mandatory part is, again, what sort of gets us in the door, I think, but that we have a statute that imposes, again, on a per conviction basis. And I think this is where the Court of Appeals opinion in Radage really highlights that what we should be looking at is the relationship between the cost that the state is undertaking and what the defendant is being charged for. Is this compensatory or is it simply punitive? And this is where we get to, in a case where there may be multiple surcharges, And Berdaj points out there's no reason to think that DNA cost continues to climb. Surely we don't take four DNA samples from a person just because they paid four surcharges. It's possible that there are defendants who have already paid a DNA surcharge in a case that involves no DNA analysis and maybe has three counts and yet is still being required to pay three DNA surcharges. And that's the problem that we have. If this were simply a fee, again, the state would be compensated for what it's spending on this. Instead, that's not what we have.
Counselor, you seem to run parallel with if it's a fee, then it's to compensate for the DNA surcharge. But it may be the DNA surcharge on a global basis rather than on the basis of one individual person. Correct? I mean, everybody that gets charged a fee, as we all know in the courts, do not pay those fees. So the fact that the surcharge is at a specified amount, I don't know how you can equate it definitively with the cost of doing a DNA analysis on the person against whom it's assessed.
Well, I think the problem is that we can't generalize necessarily. We need to be looking at the specific defendants that come before the court.
Well, you can look at the amount of money they have to pay, but what I'm grumbling about is I don't think there's any evidence to line it up with saying that's the cost of doing this person's DNA surcharge. And you seem to make that argument when you say, well, you know, they're not going to take three samples, but they're going to charge three times if someone has three convictions. Well, that, in my mind, interprets that there is supposedly a relationship between the actual cost of doing this test and the charge. And I don't know that there's anything in the record that would show that, but I think all of our experiences are that folks that are given surcharges don't uniformly pay them. So it may be a generalized participation in a cost overall. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sort of. I think the problem is then that it's punitive in that we're... It remains punitive because we're still not having defendants pay what it is that they may have imposed as a cost. These charges never go away. I acknowledge maybe not every defendant is perfect about paying these, but that never goes away. Eventually, a defendant winds up in jail for a few days because this hasn't been paid, and so they wind up facing the penalty sort of at a different time because they can't pay it.
You know, let me just talk about that for a moment. To me, it's not relevant whether they pay or not. And I'm just curious, is there anything in the record that tells us that these surcharges go to pay for DNA testing? There are, for example, let me just give you an example. I remember thinking back when trial court days, there'd be a $5 traffic ticket. I mean, that was kind of the least that you could give someone. It ended up back then being something like $98.10 because of the cost, fees, and surcharges that were tacked on. I'm not convinced that each of those cost, fees, and surcharges always go to that particular place to pay that particular cost, fee, or surcharge. Is there anything in this record to talk about the relationship between DNA surcharge, DNA testing, and that these are segregated for that sole purpose?
Nothing in the record so much as in the statutes themselves. I think that the DNA surcharge statute indicates where the money is sent.
Goes to the DOJ, doesn't it?
Right. Eventually, if you track the statutes, we'll send it to this, and then they'll send it to this. Eventually, it gets to the state. The DNA data bank is where the money goes, the Department of Justice, for that purpose. And so it does, in fact, go there, but without any regard for whether the defendant is costing anybody any money.
So do you think cost, fees, and surcharges have to be tethered to what it actually costs to do the task to which that's assigned?
Not necessarily, but if they don't, they become punitive. Is
well,
a problem.
And not necessarily. I mean, isn't it a good thing for all defendants that we have DNA testing? I think that folks have been acquitted because of the data bank that's being maintained. And I don't know why it would be punitive to have someone assist in maintaining that data bank without having the number that's ascribed to that assistance be the cost of doing the DNA test for this particular person.
Although defendants have been charged because of DNA. so it doesn't always work to a defendant's benefit.
It sort of goes both ways. And in a lot of those acquittal cases, we have 974.07, the express DNA, the post-conviction DNA testing statutes that expressly provide that the defendant's going to pay for that sample then, or any testing that has to take place then. And so similarly, I think that, again, the prior system, the discretionary system where a defendant might pay a surcharge when they gave a sample, because the state collects a sample from everybody once so they can enter it into the DNA bank, I can understand how $250 might not perfectly reflect that, but it is at least rationally related to the cost.
I think we're getting a little bit off your argument, though. Is your argument that now that it's mandatory, this particular defendant has been penalized in a way that violates ex post facto, versus before this particular defendant would have had a shot at the judge saying, hey, it's not mandatory, I'm not imposing it?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear.
Yes,
on your
and the parties agree that changing something from discretionary to mandatory can violate ex post facto, and that's what's happened here. That's sort of the rub.
I haven't read the whole record, but I don't think, on the basis of your briefs, you have a showing that $250 is an outrageous amount for a DNA test.
Correct.
Abstract, right. So it may very well be a reasonable amount for a DNA test, but that's not really your argument, whether it's a reasonable amount or an unreasonable amount. Your argument is, and I agree with Justice Eager, which I think we started this argument with, the argument is that changing from mandatory, from discretionary to mandatory, even on one conviction for a crime, one sentence for a crime committed before January 1, 2014, is a violation of ex post facto because it increases the punishment.
Right.
Punishment being a payment of an amount of money.
Yes.
Is that the correct statement of your argument, the crux of your argument?
Yes, I think so. The argument being simply that mandatory imposition of this surcharge violates ex post facto. I think that's, yeah.
Mr. Haskell, can I propose two different ways of viewing that and have you tell me which one we ought to look at? If we are moving from discretionary to mandatory, is that a problem because, A, a DNA surcharge is by its nature punitive, and therefore making it mandatory is an increase in the punitive nature of the fee, or B, is a DNA surcharge not by its nature punitive, but by making it mandatory it becomes punitive?
I think the second of those is probably more accurate. Again, a surcharge that is collected to compensate the state for something they actually had to spend money on, a defendant, I see my time is up, though.
You may finish, please.
The state is allowed, again, to be compensated even retrospectively for a cost that the defendant has created. If the state needs to collect a DNA surcharge from somebody, they may be able to collect that. But making it mandatory is the problem here, and making it mandatory in every case, again, per conviction, rather than something a little bit more narrowly tailored to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have to add the clause when the crime was committed before January 1, 2014.
Right. If the statute had said for offenses committed after January 1, 2014, there would be no ex post facto problem.
You wouldn't be here.
Exactly. Okay, very good. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. I think the discussion with Ms. Krug's counsel has focused the issue on whether this analysis in her case looks to surcharges that might be imposed on other defendants who are convicted of multiple convictions. At one point, counsel said, what makes it punitive is that it's per conviction. Now, towards the end of the argument, he was arguing that what makes it punitive is the change from discretionary to mandatory. But I think he has never made an argument that requiring his client to pay a single $250 surcharge in itself is punitive when it could have been imposed as a matter of discretion. Now,
that's why I asked him, is that his issue? Because I didn't quite take it as what was the issue set forth in the petition for review. I thought that he was arguing the Rajid case, help me with the pronunciation. Which said we save for another day whether or not our rationale would apply to a single conviction.
Right. Now, just to back up, as this case was briefed in the Court of Appeals, and I want to be clear, I'm not arguing a forfeiture issue, this notion that it's a facial challenge or kind of a modified facial challenge was not raised in the Court of Appeals.
Well, you know, I disagree with you. I looked at the Court of Appeals decisions, and I looked at the Court of Appeals briefs, and on page one of Mr. Haskell's Court of Appeals brief, they say the mandatory surcharge violates ex post facto, and this court should remand to decide whether to impose a single discretionary surcharge. And the mandatory surcharge, even applied to defendants with only one felony conviction, that is a violation of ex post facto. And if you look at the state's brief, page 7, there, and you were the lawyer too in the Court of Appeals, Mr. Castle, that if you look at page 7, the state's concession in Rodditch concerned the remedy for a defendant to whom the new mandatory surcharge statute was unconstitutionally applied. It was a facial challenge, not as applied. And the whole argument here was that it was applied to all defendants who have multiple convictions or single convictions. And that's what the Court of Appeals, the statement of the issue the Court of Appeals by you, and there were supplemental briefs there and appendices, and I looked at pages 3, 4, and 5 of your brief, and it's a general, not an as applied to this defendant. It's applied to all defendants who have a single charge, and it's being moved from discretionary to mandatory.
Yeah, perhaps I wasn't clear. What I meant to say was when I was asserting that it was argued as an as-applied, I meant that it was applied to all who were forced to pay a single surcharge,
exactly.
Not that it would brought in to apply to those who were required to pay multiple surcharges.
Because you lost that one and you accept that, right?
We accept that.
That's what I think. So this case applies to all defendants who have to pay one surcharge.
Correct.
Let me follow up.
I'm sorry. Just as Ziegler points out again, that where the crime was committed before January 1, 2014, and that clause should be into the entire case. This only is a case here because the crime was committed, allegedly, I guess it was committed, December 30th, right? 2 days before this came in. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I think Justice Bradley had If you're finished, I think Justice Bradley had a question.
Yes, the retrospective application is a sine qua non of an ex post facto. As you say, there may be other issues. In fact, there are currently in the Court of Appeals issues with the prospective application.
Yeah,
but that's not before us.
And the other issue of where the defendant has already given a DNA sample, already charged for one, and now doesn't have to give another DNA sample, but is charged anyway.
That's not before us. I have a case I have a case with prospective application claiming that because it's punitive under Radage, it has to be brought up at a plea colloquy. Again, that's not before
not
us.
This case.
Thank you. I want to make sure that this is appropriately circumscribed or appropriately broad. I hear what you have said to be that the state is not asking us to in any way overrule the Radage case. Is that correct
incorrect?
Is the state in any way asking us to overrule the Elwood case?
No.
In fact, in Elwood, the state conceded that there was an ex post facto violation.
And
so I heard the breadth. How would you frame the issue appropriately from your perspective then? What group or what people or what emphasis of the claim, since you're not attacking the Radage case, since you're not attacking the Elwood case, what is it? How should this court fashion
the way the state fashions it is a narrow issue, whether the change from a single discretionary surcharge of $250 to a mandatory surcharge of $250 for a defendant convicted of only a single felony is an ex post facto violation. Convicted of a felony that occurred before January 1st, 2014. Now,
from mandatory to discretionary, that's the issue.
Yeah. Now, what Ms. Scruggs is attempting to do, and I think it's a change in tactics, but again, I'm not arguing forfeiture. This case is before the court. Court should apply the correct legal analysis, is to say we have to look at the statute on its face. But on its face, this statute never did anything to a person convicted of a single felony conviction other than change that conviction from discretionary to mandatory. That's why I think the comparison to Daubert, the Florida, Daubert v. Florida, is apt.
That's why Justice Kelly's movement to two parts is apt.
I'm saying it's exactly as though the legislature had broken it out that way. There's really no difference. Because, again, we don't hear any argument that imposing a single surcharge has a punitive effect. So this idea of looking at a statute on its face rather than the specific application makes sense when, for example, if a maximum penalty for a crime was increased from 10 years to 15 years, the defendant is sentenced to 10 years, the defendant would not be precluded from raising an ex post facto issue because the statute on its face increased the potential penalty.
I think that's his whole argument in his brief. Look at page 5. Because the amended surcharge requires Ms. Scruggs to pay a surcharge that was not required at the time of the offense, the statute is retrospective.
What page are you reading?
Page 5 of the blue brief in this court. And that's his whole argument. Page 6, the surcharge is punitive because it increases the mandatory punishment for completed crimes.
Well, I think the retrospective gets him in the ex post facto door.
Sure.
It doesn't answer the question of whether it's punitive.
Well, that's a two-part question, intent and effect. Was there a punitive intent here, in your opinion?
No.
Why not?
Because the there's several reasons. One is the court looks to the face of the statutes, and while labels aren't controlling, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that courts give great deference to the choice of a label. This is labeled as a surcharge. It's not labeled as a fine. It's not in Chapter 939 with the penalties. Last
but
term.
It's in the criminal statutes.
Yes.
Not the civil statutes.
Right. However, the U.S. Supreme Court.
Isn't there a chapter in the statutes devoted to surcharges?
Counsel, you were going to tell us two reasons why there's no punitive intent. I got one.
Actually,
What's the other one?
I have three.
Okay.
First is the label as a surcharge.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that it is not in the criminal penalties provision. And the reason I think that's significant, obviously the issue is different, but last term this court addressed the Finley case and what punishments are a trial court required to inform a defendant about. And the court looked to Chapter 939 as the source of the punishments. That's where the legislature, so as an indicator of legislative intent. Now,
you had a third, and I don't want to interrupt your cadence, so your third one, and then I probably have a question for you.
Is that this change was part and parcel of a significant expansion of DNA collection and analysis. So there were two changes. One relatively small was DNA at arrest. That got scaled back not long after this statute was passed. But also, the big change was to expand to DNA upon conviction for misdemeanors. So the cost to the state dramatically increased. And the monies collected by the surcharge fund the entire operation of the DOJ Crime Lab's DNA analysis unit. So it goes to pay for equipment, it goes to pay for salaries, it goes to pay not only to analyzing the individual defendant's DNA and putting those results into the data bank, it goes to fund other DNA-related investigative costs, it goes to...
It might go to all sorts of good things. For me, that's not the issue. For me, the issue is, does this increase the penalty? And then when you sort of carve out what's happening here, I mean, clearly had the legislature said, you know, if the fine was previously $10,000 and they increased the fine to $20,000, you wouldn't be arguing what you're arguing, right?
No, of course not.
You'd say that's ex post facto. You can't impose $20,000 fine, right?
And I have a qualification, but...
Well, I mean, if it's, let's just say it's 20 years and $10,000,
right,
and then the legislature changes it to 20 years and $20,000. Same facts, crime committed before the effective date of that statute. You would say that fine would violate ex post facto, yes or no?
Yeah, with the caveat that if this were one of those crimes where the severity of the penalty, for example, in theft. It's graded depending on the amount of the theft.
Isn't that scenario.
If the penalty for a higher level of...
But the issue really is what gets tacked on to that fine or what gets tacked on to that case. What are the costs, surcharges, and things that get tacked on? Now, some of them were discretionary with the trial court judge. Some of them are not. They just get tacked on, right?
Correct.
So part of the issue for me would be I don't want to have unintended consequences in this case of what judges would then be required to advise people of and not require. So talk to me about that a little bit, because now I'm seeing this as it's not as clean as it appeared to me a little while ago.
I'm somewhat hesitant to get into that because that case may well be reaching the court. We've got several appeals in the pipeline in the Court of Appeals.
Where the fine has been increased, as Justice Siegler has stated?
Oh, no.
Where the surcharges change?
Based on the surcharge, I'm sorry, in the non ex post facto setting, was that what you were alluding to? Or did
well, we're deciding if this is within the ex post facto setting, so you would like us to conclude it is not.
Understood. Your question was if they increased the fine for a crime that was committed prior to the effective date, would that be a valid statute?
Well, I was trying to carve that out and say, you know, that'd be pretty clear, I think, most scenarios, that you can't increase the penalty.
Right.
You know, when you come in and you're advised of the potential penalties and the penalties go up before your sentence, that creates a whole host of issues. But there are costs, surcharges, and other things that get tacked on to a penalty in a criminal case. When do we know if those implicate ex post facto? When are the things that the defendant should be advised of before or at sentencing, and when aren't they? That's really the question.
I think the way you framed it, those are two very different questions, because the advising the defendant doesn't matter whether it's ex post facto.
All right. Then in your argument, you would say then that the 250 surcharge is really something the defendant never needed to be told about, whether it's mandatory or discretionary. It can't violate ex post facto because it's just one of those things that gets tacked on later.
Well, you know, we have a victim witness surcharge. We have many surcharges and costs. A number of them are imposed on a per count basis. The victim witness surcharge is the most obvious one.
For a crime committed before the effective date of the statute?
No, we don't have.
That's
right. Mm-hmm. But that's why I'm trying to tease out the difference between what a court is required to advise, because that, I don't think that matters.
Okay, then take that out of the equation. Surcharges and costs and fees change often.
Right.
Okay? We do bond books every year, and just things change quickly. Every time they change, is that a violation of ex post facto?
No. Not unless the change was punitive. And
or applies to a crime committed before the effective date.
But even when it applies before, as I said, that gets you in the ex post facto door.
That's
you're
right.
Still left with the question, is it punitive?
And that's what I'm trying to figure out. I mean, the change from $10,000 to $20,000 clearly is punitive.
Right.
It's part of the penalty associated with the
crime.
How do we know when a surcharge is a penalty and when it isn't? What's your best argument?
The best argument is, well, we have to look at... The simplest argument is the defendant already faced the prospects. A defendant facing a single conviction already could have had a $250 surcharge imposed.
Discretionary.
From discretionary to punitive. But to answer the ex post facto challenge, I don't think the court can avoid the looking at the larger intent effects question. The question for me, from the state's perspective, is when you apply the intent and effect standard, do you look at a surcharge that Ms. Scruggs and others who were never, or who were only convicted of a single surcharge, never faced the possibility of having imposed
one? Is your best argument that it was discretionary and it moved to mandatory, and so it's still in the range of what could have been imposed, and so it can't be punitive? Is that your very best argument?
No, and that's not the only one.
Not but, with that tone of question.
No.
I'm just trying to figure it out, because from a defense perspective, they're saying, look, I had a shot at zero, and $250 is a lot to me.
No.
So I am penalized by the fact that the judge did not exercise discretion and determine that $250 should be applied to me. That's, I think, the defendant's argument. What I hear you saying is, well, you know, it could have happened. And so because it could have happened, it's not punitive.
And I want to immediately backtrack from that.
Okay.
Because the change from a if it's punishment, the change from a discretionary to a mandatory doesn't matter. That's still...
Well, it does matter.
What's that?
If it is a change, let me put it this way. The state agrees, I think, that a change from discretionary to mandatory can be an increase in the penalty and can violate ex post facto, depending on the various circumstances.
Depending on whether it is punishment.
That's right. And whereas multiple convictions, you have conceded, the state has conceded that it's punishment. That's the Rodditch case.
The state.
And you are just not willing to say here that the state is arguing that that surcharges for single offenses. And I think this is the crux of the state's argument. Surcharge for a single offense when there's no showing it's an unreasonable amount per se, which there's no showing here, that in and of itself is not ex post facto. And that's your argument. That's the real
thank you
basis.
For articulating it more clearly.
Yeah, but you're not willing to state it the way Justice Ziegler did, and it was that she stated it in the same.
I hear you saying surcharges are not punishment.
Exactly.
I'm saying
this
single surcharge is
right.
Not
punishment. That's right. That's
in the multiple surcharge cases, I had not in the ex post facto realm, but I have had across my desk child pornography cases in which there are 200 counts of conviction. That would require a $50,000 DNA surcharge. I would not argue that that does not have a punitive effect.
Well, what if the surcharge here was instead of $250, which to me seems a reasonable charge because I think DNA testing costs more than that if you went to the state lab or went to any private lab.
Yeah, it's.
But suppose that the charge was $1,000 for a single conviction.
Well, the.
Or $2,000.
I would say the burden would be on the defendant to show that it's not reasonably related. There's nothing in this record. I'm aware
reasonably
from other
related
cases what the actual costs are.
Counsel, reasonably related to what?
To the costs the state is attempting to cover.
Right. And so it seems to me, sir, that the basic argument you're making is that by a shift from the discretionary to the mandatory nature of the collection of the surcharge is reflective of a legislative determination that this is the cost that's necessary to administer and run a program that's for the public good. Am I right so far?
I agree.
Am I right so far?
Yes.
All right. So you kind of lost me on your child pornography 200 count situation, where you just seemed to, it seemed like an off-the-cuff remark, and it seemed like one that was not anchored to an objective factor, because here I thought the objective factor, based on what you had been arguing at the beginning of your comments, was unless the petitioner can show that the collection of the surcharge is disproportionate or is not necessary to the administration of the public program, that the legislature has made the legislative determinations in the interests of the public, then it's not punitive. Am I right so far?
Yes.
All right. So consequently, I don't see how the taxation of costs, which is how we, not to be confused with a tax, so a la the Affordable Care Act, but as we describe it in when costs are attached to legal judgments, the objective standard seems to me that unless it can be demonstrated by the one who's complaining that the costs are overly inflated and have no rational relationship to the actual cost of the administration of the program, that they're therefore constitutional.
Correct.
Mr. Castle, wouldn't your best argument for the move from discretionary to mandatory be that this program, the surcharge, is meant to reimburse the state for a cost that the defendant has made the state incur, and that previously, when it was imposed on a discretionary basis, that was a matter of judicial grace. They could forgive that amount of charge, but the charge was always there to reimburse the state for a cost.
That's correct, and I think one of the reasons, perhaps the primary reason from going to a discretionary to a mandatory surcharge, was there wasn't enough money coming in when it was discretionary. Trial courts were often exercising their discretion not to impose it.
And Ms. Scruggs did indeed incur this charge. She was ordered to give a DNA sample.
Correct.
Yes. I have to ask the question then. How can you say, what was your comment based on that if a defendant, following conviction, incurs $50,000 in surcharges, then that automatically necessarily is punitive?
Well, when one looks at the effects test, one of the factors is whether the surcharge is excessive in relationship to the purpose. And I guess I don't need to concede. I think there would be a strong argument that $50,000 is excessive.
Is excessive compared to the cost of the administration of the program?
No.
Well, then what are you saying? And before someone asks you another question, I'd like you to complete your thought, because I'm genuinely curious. This is a big deal.
It is. Well, I think the state has not asked this court to overrule Dodge, so we are accepting the Court of Appeals determination that multiple surcharges are excessive. So I think under Radage, 200 surcharges would be excessive. I think writing on a clean slate, could we make the argument that the cost of the whole DNA program is in the millions and $50,000 is not excessive? Yes, if we were writing on a clean slate, I think we might make that argument. But as I said, Renage says that multiple conviction surcharges are, and we have not asked the court to overrule it.
And my favorite question is just namely.
Justice Bradley has been waiting quite a while.
Sir,
can we have
ahead,
a question?
My answers.
And as a result of these additional questions, you still are taking the position, as I understand it, that the although it may not be punitive in intent, that Radage is punitive in effect and Elward is punitive in effect. Is that
yes, and Elward was distinguishable because of a lag in misdemeanor cases between the collection imposition of the surcharge, and there's a 15-month gap.
That's what makes Elwood distinguishable from this case. That is the rollout that was described.
Right. This case, Ms. Scruggs did have to provide a sample. So
yes,
there were both direct costs attributable to Ms. Scruggs by her providing a sample that needs to be analyzed, entered and collected and analyzed.
Does the fact that the felony surcharge is higher than the misdemeanor surcharge suggest any punitive intent?
No. And I think the reason is, I guess the question is, does it reflect, it has nothing to do with, I don't think, with the punitive effect, because it was a $250 surcharge beforehand, the legislature left it in place. I don't think the legislature deciding to impose a lesser surcharge on misdemeanants changes the effect on the Scruggs, nor does it, I think, reflect an intent that now the DNA surcharge has become punitive.
Can you conceive of a non-punitive basis for having a difference in the surcharge? Because I can't conceive of a reason that DNA costs would be higher for a felony conviction than a misdemeanor conviction.
Well, I think the Court of Appeals identified one reason, which is that misdemeanor cases are less likely to involve DNA analysis as part of.
But you put them in the data bank anyway.
Excuse me?
But you put them in the data bank anyway.
Yes. But, so that's one reason. And the other is these do not have to be a perfect correlation.
Thank you.
I have a question that I always ask, and that is, you were writing the opinion. I want to know what your statement of the issue and statement of the court holding.
Statement of the issue is whether...
I knew you
so
would.
So I don't misspeak. Let me turn to that. The issue is the narrow issue whether the change from a single discretionary $250 surcharge to a single mandatory $250 surcharge for a defendant convicted a single felony offense violates ex post facto. Holding of the court should be it does not because the surcharge does not reflect a legislative intent to punish, and a $250 surcharge has no punitive effect on the
because it's a reasonable amount.
Because it is a reasonable amount.
No,
thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That still leaves open, counsel, the issue of whether the guy had already given a DNA test and no longer had to give one, but still is charged $250. That would still be open under
that
your
holding. That would still be open. It's being litigated.
Right. Okay. Good.
Please, I'm going to ask our marshal to give you an additional 5 minutes in rebuttal because the court went over by 6 minutes on the state's time. If you don't need it, fine, but if you do, we want to be sure that we give you an equal opportunity to represent the positions you're maintaining on behalf of your client as we've given to the state.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I think that there are some issues that arose in the Assistant Attorney General's discussion, or I think the questions that came from Justice Gableman, and the Attorney General's statement that we need to be looking at this as a cost in relation to something. And I think what we're looking at it is whether it's excessive in relation to what the defendant is actually being required to provide. And that's why a situation where a person pays 200 surcharges is the patently easy example of it is excessive in relation to what that defendant is going to provide in DNA. There's no indication that there are going to need to be 200 DNA tests taken.
But we know that the costs collected are more, are to cover more than just the physical act of collection, right, counsel?
Right. But the problem is that in assessing whether it's punitive or not, we need to be looking at it in relation to what the defendant created, because otherwise you're having the defendant, like Ms. Scruggs, pay for more than her fair share of the DNA data bank that is being maintained by the state.
Sure, but it seems to me it's your obligation to demonstrate, if you're going to challenge the constitutionality, that she is being required to pay more than her fair share.
Right, and that's where undoubtedly, we don't have specific evidence about the cost of a DNA test in any particular case.
And again, we're not just talking about the test. We're talking about the storage. We're talking about the storage of the data. We're just talking about administration of the program. We're talking about the personnel. We're talking about all of the necessary things that have to be in place to support any kind of program to provide information in the future. So it's I know, because when I was a trial court judge and I would order the test and someone would say, well, I already had the test. Well, the legislature passed a law and it says a new test is required. So that money goes more than just collecting the sample.
Right, and if there's concern that the $200 or the $250 doesn't adequately cover the actual cost of DNA, I don't think there would be any problem with a more narrowly tailored statute that said you need to pay more. You need to pay a little bit more to actually cover the cost. But we don't have that. We have it not tied to actual cost, but tied to the number of surcharges that sort of continue again to mount regardless of anything else, on top of which, again, we've taken what was discretionary and instead made it mandatory at this point.
So what is the objective factor that you would ask us if you were, and Justice Abrahamson's infamous question, if you were writing this opinion, what would your holding be?
I think that it's retroactive application of the mandatory DNA surcharge statute violates the ex post facto clauses of the United States and Wisconsin constitutions.
So what makes... Go ahead, Ann.
What makes this a penalty versus like all the other fees, costs, and surcharges that can change over time?
Sure. Part of it is what I think Justice Bradley was indicating, or at least was asking questions of the Assistant Attorney General about why there's a misdemeanor versus a felony. I think that looking at other jurisdictions shows how that can be reflective of punitive intent and punitive effect. I think it's State v. Stead and People v. Batman are two cases where the level of the surcharge that is being imposed increases with the perceived level of culpability. And that's what we have here, is something that we perceive the misdemeanant as more culpable than the felon, and so that person winds up paying more, despite the fact that the cost of testing their DNA, the cost of storing their DNA, the cost of future testing of their DNA isn't any different than the felons. They're simply being required to pay less because they're, again, facing a lesser penalty. The major component that makes it punitive is, again, I have to rely on the language of radage as the best indicator of a statute that imposes a cost irrespective of whatever it is that the defendant has imposed on the government. She may have imposed $0, she may have imposed $800. The statute doesn't matter. It just keeps counting on as many surcharges as it can. I think as well the location of the statute does matter. I know that the Assistant Attorney General indicated that this wasn't in 939, so it wasn't in the criminal statutes. It's in Chapter 973, the sentencing statutes, the really punitive part of the criminal code, it would seem. And so I think that that as well is indicative of a punitive intent or a punitive effect.
I have a question. Are you done with Justice Williams? Are you done with answering her?
Yeah.
Okay. Suppose that this statute said, instead of 250, which was the same amount discretionary, now mandatory, suppose it said mandatory $150. Prior statute was discretionary $250. Now it's mandatory $150. Would you be here?
Yes.
Yes, of course you would be here. Because why?
It still has changed what was once discretionary into That's something right. that was mandatory.
That had nothing to do with the amount. Because as long as it's discretionary, the defendant may have been forced to pay zero.
Correct.
Right? But once it's mandatory, the defendant has to pay an amount. And for your argument, as I understand your argument, if there is that increasing the amount from potentially zero to mandatory 100 is increasing the penalty, is increasing the punishment, increasing what this defendant has to do. And I think that's what we've heard is true, that there are many statutes that change surcharges, increase them, decrease them, etc. But I bet that they all relate to a crime committed after the effective date of the change in the surcharge.
They may, and whether they do or don't, again, at this point, even this statute applied prospectively, not a problem. And so
well,
the victim witness surcharge is there and applying.
You have to be careful about conceding that. The state says they're having cases that don't concede that.
Not an ex post facto problem. I apologize. It is
okay.
To apply
maybe
it prospectively,
okay.
No ex post facto violation.
Maybe other problems.
Right. And similarly, applying the victim witness surcharge at this point, prospectively, no ex post facto problem. Everybody is committing their offenses after that. And so there's no concern that that sort of thing is going to come
but
up.
But it may be due process or maybe something else.
Possibly, yes.
Mr. Haskell, doesn't Justice Abrahamson's question depend on an assumption that imposition of a DNA surcharge is a punishment?
To an extent, yes. I mean, our argument is, in addition to that, that the DNA surcharge is a punishment. You've taken, again, what was a discretionary...
Let's slow down for just a second. Let's say we're still talking in the discretionary realm. Is the imposition of the DNA surcharge a punishment?
That's essentially what I asked you. And you said it's in the sentencing statutes.
Right.
Which basically your answer to that.
And it is, yeah. Oh, yes, it is, and the answer will be the same in both circumstances. The DNA surcharge is punitive here because, again, it is not tied to the cost that is actually being collected.
My question is more limited than that. The imposition of one DNA surcharge in the discretionary realm, was that punishment?
Whether the prior version of the statute was, in fact, punishment?
Yes.
I think that it was a potential punishment that could have been imposed. It wasn't, at that point, it wasn't anything mandatory that a defendant was facing.
So imposing a DNA surcharge, according to you, under the prior statute, when it was discretionary, that was punitive?
Was some slight component of the punishment the defendant was facing, yes.
What slight component would that be?
Well, because, again, the court had discretion to impose only one surcharge under that prior version of the statute, and maybe a judge could have cited that on every occasion where you actually had a DNA sample that was taken from you, and in a case that involved some sort of DNA testing, some sort of sexual assault case or something involving testing, maybe the judge would have said that in that case I'm going to make sure that I'm going to impose it. In these other cases, I'm not. Maybe you've already given a sample, you've already given a surcharge. There's nothing, there's no cost to the DNA databank that you have imposed, and so we need not make you pay for something or pay for a cost that you've not created.
Counsel, I'm sorry, you done?
Hey, just if I might, when did the collection of DNA samples become mandatory?
DNA samples?
Yes.
I think that it was 1995.
Okay. So long before Ms. Scruggs' decided to engage in her activities, there was a mandatory requirement upon sentencing to give a DNA sample. So under those circumstances, she's incurring costs for the state, so they can take that sample, analyze it, store it, correct?
Right.
Right. So how would reimbursing the state for that cost be punitive under any circumstance?
It's punitive because even under those circumstances, she was facing a discretionary surcharge that is now instead something she's being required to pay that she didn't necessarily before.
Well, aside from the discretionary versus mandatory, I'm just interested in whether a DNA surcharge is punitive when it's reimbursing the state for cost incurred made necessary by Ms. Crooks. How is that punitive?
Well, and that's where I think we get into, again, the confusion of whether the statute needs to be assessed on its face versus on an as-applied basis. Whether it's one surcharge, whether it's five surcharges, simply doesn't matter. Because it can be imposed on that per-conviction basis, it remains punitive because it isn't.
Right. So we're still talking before the change, discretionary, one DNA surcharge. Punishment?
Probably not.
So moving from discretionary to mandatory, doesn't that require us to then determine whether the whether that change has a punitive intent or effect?
Yes.
So so if it is, in this circumstance, reimbursing the state because Ms. Crooks did give a DNA sample, how would that be punitive?
Because the statute does not contemplate only one surcharge being imposed. I don't know.
Okay.
Because
so,
we
if this is not Ms. Crooks doing this, if this is somebody else who got convicted for multiple counts, you're saying it's punitive as to them, and because it's punitive as to them, it must be a punitive as to Ms. Crooks too.
Yes, and I think that that's the most consistent and the only way to read this, the United States Supreme Court precedent on how to analyze whether a statute violates ex post facto. Is the statute on its face what it allows,
okay,
not the specific thing facing a particular defendant?
Well, this one only allows one DNA surcharge because there's only one conviction.
It allows as many surcharges as there are convictions. There are circumstances where maybe it's just going to be one, and I think that's what gets us back to the Weaver hypothetical where that defendant lost out on 2 years of good time. But it's still punitive if he misses out on one day of a good time. It doesn't matter what the particular defendant faces. Ms. Scruggs faced $250. Mr. Radaj faced $1,000. They're in different circumstances in that regard, but need to be treated the same for purposes of ex post facto analysis.
Counsel,
thank you, counsel.
I didn't understand your answer to Justice Kelly. You asked a good question. If I understood the question and the response. When the charge for the DNA test was discretionary under the statute, was that surcharge punishment for the offense? You answered, I think that was your question, right? And he's nodding yes. Let the record show. Scott nodding yes. Okay. And what's your answer?
I believe that it is, because it was not specifically tailored to the cost that a defendant might have provided or might not have.
So your answer is that when it was discretionary, it was a punishment for the offense. And I thought that was not the answer I think you gave him before, but I could be wrong. But that's the answer. And he's nodding yes again. But the point is, your brief says, doesn't matter whether you call it surcharge, doesn't matter what you call it. It's more like what Justice Ziegler was saying. If you increase the fine, it clearly would be a punishment. And your brief says it doesn't matter whether you call it surcharge or a fine. What you're doing is imposing an amount of money for violating a statute.
Right. I want to be careful about saying it doesn't matter that it's called a surcharge, because the Assistant Attorney General is right that there is some deference owed to what it has been called. But in this particular case, I think that the evidence overwhelms that title.
Form should not overtake substance.
Indeed.
That's your argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So this concludes our argument in our first case, State versus Scruggs. We will take a brief recess so that the students that are here can leave, and I think there is another group that may be joining us. So thank you for a good argument.